So now we're doing a better job of identifying principal investigators that are not solely white males. We now have women who are serving as principal investigators. We now have people of color who are now serving as principal investigators. And again, they are able to communicate in ways that are culturally relevant, that are culturally sensitive, that can answer the questions and give people peace of mind of what the outcomes may or may not be and what the benefits and the risks are. So there's a balanced conversation that's now happening. And I think just that sheer representation creates accountability within the healthcare system that we previously did not have. And those things are super important.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Raven Miller, the Senior Marketing Director for Medtronic's high-powered global growth team. Her work focuses on accelerating patients' access to heart failure therapies, especially by reducing cardiac healthcare disparities for women and people of color. Raven advocates for necessary speed bumps in healthcare processes that can ensure guideline-based and value-based care for all. We discuss the barriers that people of color face in assessing care, confronting our own biases, and empowering patients to advocate for themselves. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Raven. Thank you for joining me this morning. How's your 2021 so far?
Oh, everything is going great. It is so good to be with you, Christine, and with your podcast family. I really appreciate the invitation.
Oh, that's great. I'm so excited to have you today, actually. Your experience as health policy, you have experience in the market development that focuses on reducing cardiac healthcare disparities for women and people of color, and your perspective on value-based healthcare. It will be so interesting to our listener. And I thought before we start, I always like to hear our guest stories, what your journey and how you end up in the healthcare space.
Yeah, so thank you for the question. So my journey began actually as a sales rep. So I was down in Houston, Texas, as a sports medicine sales rep, having a good time. You put together sports and medicine, and I am a happy camper. So was doing that in Houston and then moved to Nashville doing that. And just had an epiphany while I was out talking to my physicians about how could I potentially do more. And then that's when I enrolled in grad school and put together this crazy journey of divinity plus business school, and then ended up at Medtronic.
That is very interesting.
Yeah. I get that all the time. But I think where the perfect place of them residing over one another is the opportunity to address healthcare disparities. So you take what you learn on the divinity side of the school, which is ethics, understanding bias, owning your own bias. And you now are combining that with the mechanics of what you learn in business, which is creating vision, achieving objectives, et cetera. And so this opportunity to address disparities of care, to me, was the perfect combination of doing good ethical work in a business space that would have ultimate benefits for our patients, especially women and people of color who tend to be underserved in many of our markets around the world. So my first journey into Medtronic was focused on addressing disparities of care, particularly for the valvular space. Made some good improvements there and then went over to the health policy world. So this was right when the Affordable Care Act was about to go in the US, and everybody was like, what in the world is going on? How is this going to change our world? What does this mean for our industry, for our company, for our patients? We don't know. And so my role was to go in with our health policy partners and really break down the Affordable Care Act and understand what impact was it going to have, what impact was it not going to have, so that we could continue to address our objectives. So I did that. as well as got a chance to do a little bit, Christine. And when I say a little bit, I mean a little bit. A little bit of government affairs work, where we partnered with the lobbyists to ensure that we were looking at bills that may inadvertently, and I do mean inadvertently, restrict care for patients who are suffering from rare and orphan diseases. So partnered with the lobbyist teams, got together some patient advocacy groups, and we were able to ensure that we created more access for patients. Again, good ethical work that helps patients get the care that they need. From there, got a chance to use a lot of that information and content that I was learning from the health policy group and take that over into a commercial operations team, which was focused on how do you create value for your customers and your patients beyond the point of care. So for those heart failure patients who are coming into the hospital, how do we do good population health management? For those patients that are really costly to the system, how do we potentially put in quality initiatives that help to drive down some of that cost by reducing variation, streamlining inefficiencies, things of that sort? And so this gave us a unique opportunity to partner with our physicians and our hospital administrators in ways that were not only better for their bottom line, but also gave a better experience for their patients. From there, I went into the venous world. So think about superficial venous disease, deep venous disease, and the embolization world. And so I did that for a few years, hardcore product marketing, making sure that we were doing launches to the market, both in the U.S. and to many countries around the world. And now I'm back into, guess what? Addressing access issues. So I'm now in the space where I'm focused on heart failure and sudden cardiac arrest, which is a passion point for me. You know, 3 out of 4 of my grandparents died from cardiovascular disease. I could argue 2 died way too early. And so from my perspective, I want to, again, make sure that we are getting the right patient, the right care at the right time. So that's my journey.
Wow, that's very exciting. Definitely a unique one when you combine the divinity and the business and the healthcare. But I kind of like how you connect them, which makes total sense. And actually, it's so much to learn from each of the different sector of that knowledge. You mentioned that, one of the things that we definitely hear a lot more, access of care, we've been, hearing a lot, but I think with the COVID, it just becomes even more front and center. And from your first experience when you were at Medtronic and how to improve access to care for the cardiac healthcare, what did you learn from that experience at that time? And then what changed and what can be done differently?
So I think a myriad of things. Let me just kind of say that a myriad of things that could probably take another hour to talk about. But I'll try to boil this down to maybe 2 or 3 of my top things. So one of the things I could not get my head wrapped around is life imitating art, or is art imitating life? And what I mean by this more specifically is clinical trial enrollment. So when we look at clinical trial enrollment, oftentimes what we see is an over-index of white males in clinical trials. And so then the results that you get may be beneficial for the entire patient population, but again, the benchmark and the normative of the outcomes is based on the over-indexing of enrollees, which happen to be white males. So if there is some sort of difference that would occur between men and women, we have to dissect that data a lot more or do a new trial so that we have an ample sample of female patients to say, for the women, we believe this might be more nuanced for that particular patient population. Same thing we see with people of color is we want to make sure that we have good representative data as we look at these clinical trial enrollments to ensure that you have outcomes that are going to be beneficial across the board. So what my company and I have been doing is trying to be more intentional about making sure that the representation in the clinical trials is also representative of what we see as a disease burden. Now the question becomes, how do you do it? How do you do it, Christine? How do you do it? Because if we look at COVID as an example, right, we saw how many people were afraid to get the vaccine. And a lot of this is based on bad behavior of what we've seen the medical systems do to patients, particularly patients of color, in the past. Mm. There is the Tuskegee experiment that many people are familiar with, where, you know, African Americans were injected with syphilis and then denied care. It was just an egregious use and abuse of power. So now you have this in the minds and seated in the minds of many people of color, not just African Americans, people of color, who don't want to be a quote unquote guinea pig. Listen, I get it. Here's what's different now, though, right? So now we have a lot more employment of people of color, African-American, Asian-American, et cetera, who are working in the medical device space, the pharma space, academic centers, et cetera. So the just the sheer representation of having these people in places and spaces that are making decisions about the clinical trials makes a huge difference. The second thing that we have is now more culturally relevant materials so that people know exactly what they're signing up for. So now patients can not only be informed, but empowered to make decisions that are better based for themselves and what they're reading based on the culturally competent materials that are now being developed. And then the last thing I would say is from a principal investigator. So now we're doing a better job of identifying principal investigators that are not solely white males. We now have women who are serving as principal investigators. We now have people of color who are now serving as principal investigators. And again, they are able to communicate in ways that are culturally relevant, that are culturally sensitive, that can answer the questions and give people peace of mind of what the outcomes may or may not be and what the benefits and the risks are. So there's a balanced conversation that's now happening. And I think just that sheer representation creates accountability within the healthcare system that we previously did not have. And those things are super important. I would say the second thing, and then I'll stop because, again, I love this topic. I could talk about it forever, is ensuring that we have quality initiatives that are in place. Quality initiatives that are in place. So there was a story that I heard when I first joined my company where there was an African-American woman who was jogging in a park in Atlanta near one of the major hospital systems. So she's running, pretty active, but she had a syncopal event, meaning she passed out, right? So they take her to the ER and they're like, got her on the table. And they were like, okay, well, we've determined that she probably has CAD and we need to give her a stent. And they said, okay, well, which stent should we give her? And the folks in the room automatically said, you know, she's probably some sort of dopehead. Just give her a bare metal stent because she won't be able to afford it. She happened to come out of consciousness and was like, I am a physician who is employed at this hospital. I have insurance. Do the right thing. Just those types of things, right? And it was an astonishing story, but it also is reflective of some of the biases that many of us inherently have. So all people have bias. So let's recognize that. That's one of the things we learn in divinity school is everybody has bias. The crazy part about that is you can even have bias against people in the groups that you are representative of. So I, as an African-American, can still have biases against African-Americans, women, et cetera, because these biases are learned, right? They are learned. And so what we now need to do within our healthcare systems is put speed bumps into the decision-making processes, into some of the workflows that we have to ensure that we are holding ourselves accountable, not to fall prey to the biases. And so there are things that we're looking at now that we can do in partnership with hospital systems, such as clinical decision support tools that help people ensure that there is standardized care and less variation in care that's being rendered to all patients, regardless of who they are. So those are two things that I'm very passionate about, if you can't tell.
Yeah. It's so much to learn from. And I have not heard that stories about the women. That is kind of like, that's crazy. But I'm sure that is not one event that ever happened. I'm sure it happened in different way that we did not hear about. You've mentioned about speed bump, about biases, and oftentimes when a patient comes to emergency room, everything can be rushed. But how do you create that speed bump to make people pause rather than react naturally what's on their bias? Because things have to move fast sometimes.
They do have to move fast. So one of the things that we all know is education is key. So just, you know, what you see and what gets measured gets done, right? What gets measured gets done. So how do we put protocols in place that measure the outcomes and the behaviors of what we desire to see, which is guideline-based medicine? And so to the extent that we can work with hospital systems to create opportunities to measure those outcomes is a good thing. EMRs are helping people to be more accountable as well. And one of the things that we've seen that is starting to work, you know, we're actually, running pilots similar to this now, is looking at how do you put clinical decision support tools that don't make the decision. They don't make the decision for the physician, but they at least put reminder bubbles in to say, hey, have you considered X, Y, and Z based on this patient's criteria? It's just enough of a pause to say, is this something that we should consider? Or based on what else we see about this patient sitting in front of us, we need to go a different way. But it at least creates the pause to say, are we following guideline-directed medicine based on what the societies have rendered is appropriate care? And again, that accountability piece of then tracking outcomes, measuring outcomes, talking about patient satisfaction scores, right? How were they treated? Did they feel like they walked away with understanding the information in a way that was comprehensible to them? It's also a good check because, again, we know this information in and out, backwards and forwards, but it's the patient that we still have to communicate to come along this journey so they can be empowered and informed and know what options they have. Because we want to make sure that patients are able to speak up and be advocates for themselves as well.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping med tech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
Yeah, no, that's great. As you know, via the Roseman Institute, we support a lot of the startups. And many of our entrepreneurs are interested in healthcare because they really want to make an impact on a patient outcome. And, you know, meeting many of them, they really want to, you know, how can they help as many people as they can? And what recommendation, what advice do you have for, you know, a lot of the startup when they think about developing their technology so that, like, for example, the clinical trial that makes sure that it's not just certain population? Or is there other things that they need to think about?
So one of the things I think we definitively want to do is make sure that we're actually addressing a problem. And some of that comes from just good market research. So not just interviewing, and this is honestly some of the mistakes I think I personally have made in the past. So what I would say is learn from me. Don't make the same mistakes I did. Make sure that you are interviewing various stakeholders that are within an organization. So oftentimes we go and we talk to the physician who is going to be handling the product. Great, that's fine. You definitively want to get their buy-in. But what is this going to mean for the staff that is in the room that might have to prep the product? What else are they having to do at the same time in that same procedure where now your product is either going to be disruptive to their workflow or potentially streamline their workflow? Can it make their work easier? Making sure that you are talking to some of the nurses that have to do the follow-up. So is it good for them? And is it helping their job? Is it making the patients happy? Those are the types of things that I think you can learn from the nursing staff. Definitively want to get some good feedback from hospital administrators, because when we start thinking about what's going to be on the shelf, what's going to be prioritized, what's going to come on contract, definitively want to make sure that they are on board and that they are bought into what you're doing. So many times we have products that we want to bring to market and it feels really good because we think it's cool. But does your ultimate stakeholders also believe the same thing? One of the other pieces you might want to consider is, have we talked to the patients? Especially if this is going to be something that is considered elective procedures. Oftentimes with those elective procedures, you're going to find that the patient has a lot more say in whether or not they decide to move forward with that procedure, just as much as the physician can offer it to them. So what I've seen based on my career journey, and again, this is an N of one, is the patients that are involved in elective procedures have they have a lot more opportunity to say yes or no. So you want to make sure that you understand how the patient will realize the benefits, the risk, what decisions are they going to be considering before they move forward with having a procedure that perhaps you or your company didn't consider. So those things are going to be super important as you think about building out your outline. And then finally, I think most people know this already. I mean, this is a really smart crew, so I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But payers. If it doesn't get paid, it won't get implanted. We found that out the hard way. So we had a product that we were utilizing. And listen, it was great outcomes. Patients were happy with it and for it, but getting the payers bought into it ended up being the barrier to a faster ramp is what I would say. So making sure that you have payers bought in beforehand is also going to be key in order to be successful for the long haul.
Oh, thank you. And I think that's, it's revalidate a lot of the things that what you're saying is aligned with a lot of what a lot of other experts been telling. But one of the things that I want to switch a segue to you mentioned that you have a lot of discussion with the provider on the Affordable Care Act, talking about the value-based healthcare. What is that conversation like? Because I think a lot of the time the innovators, they need to convince the hospital, like what you're saying, like this is a product that makes sense for the patient, makes sense for the clinician, but it also makes sense for the hospital and it will get paid. Share us the insight that you have on that discussion.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in this space. There are some days where I was up then partying and celebrating. And there were days when I wanted to go in my bed and cry. So I have a lot that I can say about this one. Okay, what I would say first is the value-based healthcare conversation is one that is cutting edge. And so just like you are an innovator in your space as a startup, there are innovators in the provider space. Meaning that if you look at this curve, right, the bell curve, I would say that we are still on the left-hand side of the curve. We are still on the left-hand side of the curve where we're dealing with innovators and people that are starting to take it up. And so from a value-based healthcare perspective, what I would say is fully integrated delivery networks. So those IDNs are really ideal customers and stakeholders that you might want to target for those value-based healthcare conversations. They owned everything from end to end. So they get it from an outcomes perspective. They get it from a cost effectiveness perspective. They get it from a patient satisfaction perspective. So all of those things are being held in tension with one another, and they want those things to benefit from one another. And so those are the ones that I find are more forward thinking as it relates to value-based healthcare. I think right behind that is your GPOs or your group purchasing organizations, where you're talking with not just the physicians, but the administrators of the GPOs. Mm-hmm. Because again, from a value-based perspective, they're going to want to know what is the cost effectiveness of this device? What efficiencies can we get out of this device? How do we reduce variation potentially with your device? How is this additive to our processes? Because now they also have a great number of hospitals where they can scale. So it's not going to be beneficial for just one site. They can scale across multiple hospital segments. And so those two types of hospitals, based on my own journey, I think are the best two types of segments. And so, you know, just like you're doing any other types of segmentation, this is the type of segmentation I would highly recommend for some of the stakeholders that are here on the phone, because all hospitals and all providers are not alike. They're incentivized differently. They work together differently. And so the IDNs and the GPOs tend to be better conversationalists from my journey with the value-based healthcare.
And how, you know, it's not every hospital is the same. Not every GPO is the same. But at the same time, sometimes customized for every single one of them can be very challenging when you're a startup company. And how do you advise companies to approach it?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I get it. You know, even as a large company, we only get a certain amount of resources. You know, I go back to my GM all the time. I'm like, can I have some more money? So I get it. What I would say is for those that are looking to try to get some wins here, anytime you can identify some sort of IDN or GPO that has voice on the podium, who has influence in the market, who is willing to experiment with you and not hold it against you, those are the types of hospital providers that I would maybe look for. So there are, again, going to be folks that are innovators, and you think about the segmentation piece. There are some who want to be influencers. They want to be on the cutting edge. And you can find that as you read through some of the journals, as you look at who's standing up on podium in the societies where your devices might be relevant, as you read some of the papers that are coming out of the hospital administrator groups, those are the ones that I think are probably more willing, if you will, to try to learn and experiment alongside you. You think about some of the hospitals that maybe have entrepreneur startup hubs that they own or that they work with as well, that have a history of that. that tells you already that there is a bend that they have towards innovation, towards entrepreneurship, towards trying new things that I would recommend. Some of them even have grants. I'm sure you all are familiar with that. Some of them have grants that they award for innovative startups, right? You look at some of the Cleveland Clinics of the world, and they will call out what the new innovations are that are being used in their hospital system. So those types of publications, from my perspective, kind of shine a light on who might be ideal to partner with as if you have limited resources, but you need a big bang. Because once you get the right person or the right hospital system or systems to partner with you, you get the wins that you need. It won't be just you marketing it anymore, right? It will be them as well, because they now see it as a means of differentiation within their space, differentiation with their patients, where they're adding extra value that's going to be a benefit for them. So hopefully that answers your question, Christine, would be my approach.
Oh, that's great. Well, I know we're running out of time. There's so much more that we can talk about. But before we leave, I just heard that you're a brunch enthusiast, and you even have two chapters on your brunch. And I thought that was really interesting. Tell us more about this brunch chapters, and how do we get invited to your brunch?
I love to brunch. Okay, everyone. Brunch is the most important meal of the week, not just of the weekend, of the week. So I have a brunch chapter that is in DC. I have another one that is in Minneapolis. So if you are on LinkedIn and you ever travel to Minneapolis, especially because that's where I currently live, and sometimes to DC, you'll see where I post. If you are ever in town, I will take you to brunch. I will personally treat you to brunch. So just let me know when you're in town. Hit me up on LinkedIn and say, hey, Raven, I'm in town. Taking you up on that brunch. I will say, meet me here and we shall dine over mimosas. So just let me know when that happens. Happy to do it.
I'm looking forward to it. So it's great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a great time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.